Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and I'm opening up a work session on Senate Bill 5515 in the Department of Higher Education. And I'm going to turn it over to Steve Bender, who's going to talk about the agenda, and then start. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agenda for today's work session is to hopefully work through the following items. First, to review the department's compliance with budget notes that were approved last session. There's a one-page sheet here that says DHED budget notes 2005-07. These are not budget notes that are being proposed for the upcoming session. These were ones that were actually passed 2 years ago. So I just wanted to go through those and indicate if the department had complied with these or not. The next item on the agenda will be for higher ed to respond to various questions that were asked yesterday. They have numerous materials here that we'll be referring to, or they'll be referring to, when they respond to your questions. And finally, what will probably take the most amount of time is to look at performance measures and to go through those. I think that, Mr. Chair, I know we didn't discuss this in detail, but I think that it might be helpful for the subcommittee to look through these, to note if there are any objections, and then to defer actually approving these measures and targets until after the ultimate funding level decisions are made, because some of these could affect the targets somewhat. But at least in this discussion, you'll be able to indicate whether these performance measures seem reasonable to you and whether you have any questions of the agency regarding them. And that would be the hope to be able to complete that today. If I may just start briefly with the one-page sheet that talks about the Department of Higher Education budget notes from 2005-07. There were five budget notes that were approved by the legislature last session that relate to the operating budget. There was an additional budget note that related to the capital construction budget, and that will be discussed with Senate Bill 5516. But it is part of the Ways and Means process, as you know, to review agency compliance with prior budget notes during each budget hearing. And if I can briefly summarize these, I don't think it's necessary at all to read them verbatim, but to briefly summarize what the budget notes did is the first one dealt with funding for that was provided for an integrated K-12 student data system. This has been since, it wasn't at the time of this particular budget note was written, but it's since become more known by its acronym, the ITDS, IDTS, the Integrated Data Transfer System. And as you can see, there was about $2.1 million appropriated last biennium, and there is a request for additional funding of approximately $800,000 this biennium as the second phase of that project. But basically, this budget note did require certain presentations be made in relating to providing additional information before funding was released. And the agency did comply with this budget note, and the funding was ultimately released by the emergency board for this project. The second budget note was relating to $1 million that was included in the 05-07 biennial budget for faculty recruitment and retention. And the budget note just said that these funds shall be used, there were $1 million, for purposes of recruitment and retention of highly qualified faculty. And these funds were distributed to the campuses as a separate item and used for faculty recruitment and retention. We don't have specific data from them as to how many faculty received support from this funding, but we do believe that they are in compliance with this budget note as well. The third budget note dealt with basically two limitations One of them was a limitation on tuition rate increases for resident undergraduate students. Of course, resident here means Oregonian students. It doesn't mean that they're living on campus. It's these are for Oregonian undergraduate students. The tuition rates were limited to 3% per year on average. Some students were allowed to have higher than 3% tuition rate increases. Other students had lower rates, but on average, on a weighted average, these rates were not to exceed 3% per year. The second element of Budget Note 3 is that they're basically all found in the last sentence. It said that the subcommittee further expects that the department will limit its resource fee or energy surcharge, including energy surcharge fee revenue, to no more than 9.1% of the gross tuition revenue. This budget note was complied with, and indeed these rate limits were maintained, or met, I should say. The next item refers to fee remissions. Last session, the cap that had existed on fee remissions was removed. It had been set at 8% of total tuition and fee revenues. That was eliminated. The budget note said that with this elimination, there's a requirement to report on how the elimination of the limitation was being implemented and what the effects were. And the agency did report to the emergency board. It actually turned out as part of that report that although the limitation of 8% was eliminated, the system did not award fee increases above 8%. So in that sense, there was no effect of the elimination of this limit, but they did report on that fact. And the fifth budget note stated that the Oregon University System was directed to include continued funding for the Policy Consensus Center. That, as you've heard already, is a policy option package in this particular budget as submitted by the governor. This budget note was actually met and exceeded in the sense that the request that comes forward to you is not for continued funding but for expanded funding, so it would allow the program not only to continue but to be expanded. So LFO believes that the agency complied with all of these budget notes, and if I may, Mr. Chair, state here in this public setting that we think that we were very pleased with the agency's willingness to work to comply with these budget notes. We think it was very commendable, the efforts that they made, because some of these, when you actually try to implement them and to see whether they are going to hold or not, particularly number 3, where you're talking about tuition rate increases and the number of different tuition rates and the categories for full-time students and part-time students is becoming very complex, it's not always obvious exactly what you have to do in order to make sure that you met that requirement. And the department worked extensively with LFO during the interim in attempts to determine what was probably the legislative intent. And we do thank them for their willingness to do this work. And in some cases, I think probably they didn't hear the answers that they might have hoped to, but when they didn't, they still worked to comply with these budgets.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Mm-hmm. Walker?
Thank you. I have a question about well, I actually do. On number 3, when you talk about limited tuition and resource fee, including the energy surcharge fee, and they complied with that, and I see that we got a letter today in response to my question about the energy fee. And it appears that only 2 campuses are still using that, so it must not have been too difficult to comply with that. Though when we get to addressing that issue, I'll talk about this letter. But my next question is, these are the budget notes for last biennium, which is great, but I'd like to see the budget notes that we're looking at for this biennium so that before we get to Monday. So are we going to have access to those?
Senator Devlin, do you have a response to that?
I think Representative Galizio would have probably the chair would have the same response as I have. I've been continuously handed new budget notes almost every day. I got one one again today that I have to hand on Ms. Bender. I don't know actually how many of the budget notes the co-chairs can actually entertain in the budget, because as you can see here, they only had five. I think we're well above five now.
Yeah, I was getting budget notes handed to me outside. I was getting pulled off the floor, you know, on the back of a napkin from people saying, here's the budget. So,
could we have maybe, Mr. Chair, a draft of some of the suggestions? Because I don't want it to be like it was last week, partly because I took care of the budget note from last week. I just trumped the budget note and passed an amendment and put it into statute. And I expect that to be concurred with once it leaves off the Senate floor. But my committee's now closed, and I can't do that anymore. So I don't have those resources quite as readily available as I did last week.
Right, and the chair doesn't have all the budget notes yet, and the chair's not sure which are going to make it through, though.
Okay.
I'll talk to one of the co-chair on my side, if you talk to the co-chair on your side, and we can try to move that along so we get those budget notes, those that
That'd be great. I'd like to see them this tomorrow, because I anticipate we're going to be having conversations with the chair and the vice chair over the weekend.
Yes,
I think we could give you by tomorrow the general idea of the type of budget notes that we
should.
If I just may clarify the budget note process for members who've been on Ways and Means before, and for new members as well, that the budget note process is such that typically budget notes are not brought to a subcommittee vote unless the three people who are going to be required to end up signing off on the budget report before it goes to the floor have agreed to that. And those three people are the two co-chairs and the chair of the subcommittee. So we've had a number of suggestions, or I've received a number of suggestions to draft up budget notes, and we're going through that process to see which of these are going to be moving forward. If you, as members of the subcommittee, would like to see any budget notes included with this budget, I would ask you to contact Chair Galizio, because he would be, of course, one of the people who would need to sign off on that. And we can get those drafted. Usually, you can present that as an idea, and typically LFO would try to draft something up and run it back by you to see if it met your expectations. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Warner.
Thank you. For those of us who are Ways and Means Committee freshmen, it would be interesting and useful to me to understand the purpose of the budget notes and the efficacy of the budget notes. My suspicion is that budget notes do not have the force of law because they're not voted on by the two houses and signed by the governor, and that's the definition of the law. And so I'm a little bit at a loss as to what kind of animals these things are, whether they're pious requests or threats of future retaliation if you don't do them, or what they might be. Those are among the possibilities that occur to me. I would say that if the committee staff correctly characterizes the way in which budget notes are managed, that that's an essentially undemocratic process that doesn't comply with the usual rules that other kinds of policy statements are handled in the legislature, and that budget notes ought to be presented to the subcommittee, and opinions about them at least should be solicited, that the full committee ought to determine whether these are in fact the budget notes that the committee wants to require for that particular budget item, and that somehow or some process or another ascertained as to determine whether or not the House and the Senate actually agree with those budget notes or not. Otherwise, I don't know what they are. I don't know what they'd be for. If they're requests for a study, perhaps, or something of that sort. But as I look at these budget notes, I mean, number two at least looks like it's sort of a clarification of a budget item. That might be appropriate. But I don't know why that wouldn't go in the law that established the appropriation in the first place. Some of the others appear to be limitations on the way money is to be expended. That probably ought to be in the law as well. Those will probably ought to be in the law as well if they are true limitations that the committee expects to be complied with. Let me just simply say that the fact that something is traditional does not mean we should continue doing it that way. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnett.
Mr. Chair, how deep you want to go into this? I'm going to avoid this.
I think that was an important. I think these are important points. I don't know that I want to continue a lengthy discussion. The students already look bored. I'm used to that
as well. But these are extremely important matters, and we should need to discuss them.
Yes, you're right. You're right.
Mr. Chair, it's just another little dust up on my part. It was an important dust up, and that's why I took a bill in my committee last week and stopped an amendment and forced it to trump the budget note that we talked about that I couldn't change. So you all have seen that on the floor. And that's sort of where I am with the thought about it.
Yeah. Good points. Mr. Bender.
Thank you. Just to respond to some of the representative's comments, he's correct that budget notes are not law and that a violation or noncompliance with a budget note is not a violation of the law. The bills that you have before you, the appropriation bills, only contain appropriations and limitations of expenditures and do not contain specific instructions in them as to what is being funded and what types of decisions the subcommittee and full committee of Ways and Means made in determining what the ultimate level of funding is. What the budget notes are designed to do is to provide additional information as to the legislative expectations of the agency and how the budget is, the expenditures that are being provided are to be used. And they are simply instructions, and one of the difference between budget notes and other comments in the budget report, which also provide these types of instructions, is that the budget notes are by custom voted on by the subcommittee verbatim. The wording is placed before the subcommittee for the vote, and they are then, compliance is typically pointed out and reported on the next legislative session as we are doing now for this. So they should be viewed as a way of elevating the level of of a subcommittee expectation as to how the budget will be implemented to such a level that it is clear that all members have approved the language and that there is an expectation of a report back.
Thank you, Representative Morgan.
I very much appreciate Mr. Bender's comments because I think that the points that he brought out are points that are very important. There is a divide here between policy committees and fiscal committees, it's always been what I perceive to be a weakness in the system that there isn't a very firm connection between the two, and there really is no vehicle for budget committees to enter into the policy discussions. We always are kind of involved in this at the end of the policy discussion. And so budget notes are the vehicle that the subcommittees and the full committees and the co-chairs have to communicate their expectations for how things should unfold. And I disagree very much with my compatriot from Eugene here, these are voted on by these subcommittees. They are voted on by the full committee, and they are voted on by the members of the House. And they should be subject to discussion, and they should be, decision points that we all take into consideration when we decide whether to support these bills or not. But I think that it is important to maintain an avenue where this part of the process has the ability to express the desires that have come forward, both for how the money should be spent, the requests that we have for accountability on how that money's spent. We ask for a lot of reporting and that kind of thing to take place. We also ask for information to help inform the discussion that we have the next time we have it. So I would be very hesitant to say that not having budget notes is a good idea, but I also think that they should be open to scrutiny, and that they should be part of the discussion and part of what people are voting on when they vote for the bills.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Barnett?
Thank you. Just very quickly, I don't believe that Representative Morgan and I disagree on the substance.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Devlin?
I was just trying to confirm with Mr. Bender if my memory is correct. In terms of our appropriations bills, and we just list the expenditures under various line items, I believe we are actually prohibited from putting any policy statements into the appropriations bill.
Yes, the Constitution does prohibit bills that appropriate money from dealing with other matters as well.
A pesky document.
Mm-hmm. Well, but we're up hold. Just a quick response to that, and I understand that's in the Constitution, and that it makes it even more important that we not do precisely that through the back door.
All right, Mr. Bender, what philosophical conundrum are you going to introduce for our next?
I hope none. I just want to ask the agency to come forward. They have distributed a number of materials that are responses to questions that the subcommittee had or requests for particular information. I would appreciate if someone can come forward just to simply identify what these items are and to give a brief explanation to allow subcommittee members to respond to the information that the system is providing me.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance of the Oregon University System. I provided, I believe, three letters in your packet and the report that you asked for from the Common Fund that we discussed yesterday. I'll just go through these letters very quickly with you. The first letter was in response to a question about faculty salaries. There's a question, what would it cost to get OUS faculty salaries up to the peer average, as I understood it? The answer to that question is approximately $44 million a year. And our faculty salary base is about $200 million per year. And we are presently at about 83.5% of our peer average. If you do the arithmetic and then you add the required other payroll expense items, you'll find that $44 million number works out in the calculation. Obviously, that's a moving target. The peer average just moves every year, and if we don't keep pace with that, it would cost more or less money depending on what the peers do. Yes.
Are we talking about just salary or all compensation?
We are talking, excuse me, Mr. Chair, in this letter, we're talking $44 million of total compensation, of which 33.7 is salary, and then our other payroll expenses, for instance, the PERS contributions, the FICA required contributions, and other things approximate about 30%. At the moment, and that's an approximation. Those numbers bounce around year to year.
My question is, I don't think I know this clear, or maybe you just answered it, and I'm not understanding it. In other words, we're at 83% of peer institutions
for salaries.
for salary.
Yes.
Not for salary and benefits, health care, et cetera.
All right, Mr. Chair, let me take another shot at your question. For salaries only, okay, we're at about 83.5%. For total compensation, if you include the health care and retirement contributions, we're in, I don't have this precise number, but I'm going to say we're at about 90%. This question, as I understood it, was addressing salaries. And that's how I answered it. I suppose I should have, you know, put the secondary caveat in.
Right, no, thank you. No, that was the question. This was just curiosity, I just
clarification.
Representative Morgan.
If I might. Mr. Kempney, in the first paragraph it says the answer is that it would take a recurring increase of approximately $44 million per year. So that means that in the, if we were to do this, we would need to put $88 million into the biennial budget every time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, you are absolutely correct. It is a, that's a one-year increment. Well, actually, it would recur, but it would take $44 million. If you did it in the first year of the biennial, it would take $44 million times two, roughly. So.
Steve.
Well, just to clarify, that this would be $88 million that would then become part of the base,
right,
for the next biennium. So it wouldn't be an additional.
And it would be a roll-up on,
right,
it, but it would still be there in
yeah,
the subsequent biennium.
I'm sorry if I wasn't clear.
And again, this is just to get the Oregon University system to average. Is what we're talking. I mean, this is right,
Mr. Chair, and that's correct. And only for full-time faculty. Okay. This is the benchmark group. Is full-time faculty. It does not include part-time faculty.
There to be average.
Can I ask
that? Senator Devlin, did you have?
No, I think okay. Mr. Bender clarified it.
Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clinton, you said that we're in the low 90% for total compensation, so we seem to be doing better with the rest of the package than with the salaries than other states. So can you elaborate on what it is that we add to the pie to make it a little better?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, as I mentioned in my previous testimony to this body, our benefits are better than the average benefits across the country. Our health care contributions are somewhat higher than our peers, and our retirement contributions are higher than our peers as well. Part of this, which Senator Devlin may want me to address, relates to the fact that Oregon has chosen to fully fund its unfunded pension liability, and some other states have not addressed that issue yet, but our costs are higher.
Senator Devlin? And I think in addition to that would be an understanding that because some of the faculty members are Tier 1 and some are Tier 2, but for new faculty members coming in from out of state, well, it's a fair system. Our new system is probably more on average or below average of what they would get for a retirement system in another state as a new employee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's roughly correct. It's a little higher still than the average in the nation, but you are correct. The 2-3 or the OPSRP populations, which is the new PERS program, is significantly less costly than the Tier 1 and Tier 2 populations.
Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator. Representative Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be useful to get that other implied number. That is, what would it be if you worked from the number of total compensation rather than from the number of wages? You've given us the salary number. What would it be if we worked from the total compensation number instead? I'm sure it would be something less than that because you've indicated that we're in the low 90s now, and that might be useful as well. I'm also aware, Mr. Chair, as I'm asking the question, that because we're 105% funded at PERS, the likelihood is relatively high that the PERS rate is going to go down. and that means our costs will go down overall, over the whole system, not just at the universities. And that, so that the real number is probably somewhere between the number he's presented today and the number I just asked for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnett, we're happy to provide that data on Monday, if that's okay, or I can email it.
Thank you.
It's not a difficult calculation.
Are you requesting that data?
Yeah, if we could, and we're not going to.
That's fine.
Are we moving the
homework over the weekend?
Are we moving the bill today?
No, we're not.
So we'll have a chance to look at it again.
Absolutely. I was just confirming. I wanted to confirm.
Well, I would ask whether this is purely an academic exercise or if there's some point to discuss.
if I may, Mr. Chair, there is a point, and the point is there are still some people in this building who don't believe that the university system is way behind and very seriously underfunded. It is. This is one more illustration of that fact.
And we do have in 55-15, there's a line item for faculty salaries. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, the next ledger I'll talk to you about is the resource fee ledger. And there were a couple questions about resource fees. One, you know, how much were resource fees by institution, and then some questions about energy surcharges. And if you'll direct your attention to the last page of this letter, the attachment is a spreadsheet. Our most complete fiscal year was 05-06 that I could get a hold of quickly, and this is information that we presented to our board in May when we had a discussion about fees in response to some other legislative concerns. And we can see that there are some institutions that rely more heavily on resource fees than others. The predominance of resource fees are in the graduate area, and so you'll see probably the larger institutions have more resource fees on average than do the regionals because they have more graduate programs. We have three types of resource fees, just to clarify some things that were said yesterday. One is called a universal resource fee, and that's a fee assessed to all students. And those include energy surcharges, technology fees, etc. And the technology fees I'd just like to spend a minute on are actually a fee that each of our campuses have a student committee that advises typically the chief information officer, and that committee makes recommendations about the level of the fee and the types of services they would like to purchase, if you will, with that money. The next type is programmatic resource fees, and these are fees that are assessed to students who are admitted to certain programs. And these funds are typically used to supplement the services that the students receive in those programs, be it providing internship opportunities, placement services. Sometimes there are lecture series where professionals in the field come into the classroom and talk to the students about opportunities in real life situations and other things of that order. The last time is called a one-time resource fee. It's assessed to students one time. Typically, these are matriculation fees that are assessed to students when they first come to the university. Typically, those funds are used to fund orientation activities and other pre-registration advising functions that occur with those new students. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. In terms of, if I may, before you do that, the energy surcharge was asked about specifically yesterday, and as you'll note on the spreadsheet, only two institutions continue to do that, Eastern and University of Oregon, and explanations of why they do that are included in the letter. I will note that yesterday's Oregonian, I believe, noted that both Pacific Power and Portland General Electric are announcing 10% rate increases effective, I believe it was July 1, due to some BPA credit discontinuations. But So we still have significant challenges with rate increases. We have engaged consultants and otherwise, you know, tried to do bulk buys of natural gas on the spot market and other activities of that nature to try to mitigate some of those increases. Yet, it's a challenge that all campuses are facing today.
Thank you very much.
Senator
Walker?
Thank you. Mr. Kenton, I appreciate this. But your first sentence under Eastern Oregon University made me chuckle when I read it. EOU has maintained the energy surcharge because EOU needs the revenue. It needs the revenue. You're taking it from the students, and you need the revenue. Then the next sentence says that energy continues to be a very large expense that is inflated more rapidly. I haven't seen evidence of that. I don't know why they're the only institution that continues to use the energy fee. University of Oregon, when they first implemented, according to your letter, they did that, but then the students imposed the additional burden on themselves because they want green energy. So why is it that Eastern Oregon University has a higher expense for energy than any of the other institutions? Now we're only at two. One wants to do it and one didn't ask for it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I took these responses verbatim from the campus. It is a very direct statement, I agree. Eastern does buy through a cooperative arrangement with Oregon Trail Cooperative. The price dynamics in that region may be different. I'm not intimately familiar with their energy market, but they do buy from a very small cooperative provider, and that could be part of the issue. EOU is having, you know, financial challenges, as are most of our institutions, but I think they're magnified over there. They're, you know, with enrollment challenges and other, you know, other problems they've had. So
that's fine. It's just that it also says that they intended to move the amount into tuition, but they haven't been able to do so because of tuition caps. So it's really a backdoor tuition increase. And, you know, if they want to lower their energy costs, why don't they put a wind farm out there instead of assessing students a fee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Devlin. Not to point out the obvious, but it's compared to the universities that are in the Willamette Valley, the temperature extremes where Eastern Oregon is would obviously probably need more in terms of heating. Mm-hmm. And if they had the benefit of air conditioning in all the buildings, which I don't know, probably Representative Jensen would know that, would probably have more need of air conditioning. Plus, I believe they have some of the older buildings that are in the system, some of them. In fact, one of them, I believe, is in our capital construction budget in Mohall, which I believe has been on the capital construction request. I believe this is the third or fourth finding that it's been on the request. So.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think Senator Devlin is correct in some parts as far as the Eastern Oregon University is concerned. They do get considerably more sub-zero weather than you get on this side of the Cascades.
You can keep it there, too.
That's right. thank you. We probably are happy to do that because, and in part, Representative, we probably would like to do that because it is by having some of that sub-zero weather over there that we're able to have some snowpack in the mountains, which provides, therefore, water down the Columbia River for the use of the folks over here in the west side of the Cascade. So it is of an economic benefit to the rest of the state of Oregon that we have this sub-zero weather. RE, the issue of a wind farm there, I think there may be some efforts in various and sundry places to do this. the, I haven't talked to the president nor the chancellor on this particular issue, but if the good senator from Eugene would like to introduce a bill to authorize an experimental wind farm for purposes of use at Eastern Oregon University, where they might also be able to sell that to help compensate, I expect I can talk to chancellor and the president of Eastern Oregon University into some consideration of that. I don't know that. But
thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jensen, now that you all have seen the wisdom of our ways to pass Senate Bill 838 and Renewable Energy Initiative, maybe we will be able to do that.
Well, we'd be happy to try to help and accommodate in any way we can that would generate a cash, positive cash flow for us, whether it's at the university or any other way in the eastern part of the state.
I would love it if we could by 4 o'clock start the performance measures. So, Mr. Kenton, I think you had one more, and I'm not laying the blame on.
Mr. Kenton, I don't know that you're the correct person to answer this, but the amount of fees and the number of fees that are levied on students is one thing that's really changed since my days in college. And I'm curious as to whether the amount of the fees that are assessed is part of what's considered when financial aid awards are made, or are the awards made just on the tuition levels?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, my understanding in talking to the financial aid officers is that they make an estimate of the average fees that are paid by students in addition to the tuition. I mean, the typical financial aid budget has tuition and fees, an average amount of fees, has books and supplies, transportation, room and board, and some miscellaneous things, and that is included in their financial aid package. Now, there are students who pay more than that average, and students that pay less than that average that you could argue are not being fully funded, but there is an effort to do that. And, you know, most of the time there's limited amounts of both federal and institution as well as state provided financial aid that leaves a student exposed and having to take loans or what have you. And we do have a committee that we're working very closely with OSA and the student body leadership, looking at those very issues, trying to make these fees more transparent, trying to make sure that we build them in as much as we can into these financial aid budgets for awarding purposes, and I think we're making progress in that regard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Help me just a little bit with a continuation on Representative Morgan's question. Generally, your fees are not out of line with comparable universities, are they? Or can you make an assessment or evaluation of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, our tuition is not out of line with our peers. I don't know that we have a detailed study on fees, to be honest.
Mr. Chair, it's more or less anecdotal because I didn't look at the thousands of universities in the United States when I was doing this, but I looked at the tuition at the Oregon schools, you know, versus the tuition at some other universities, some around here, some back into the Midwest. I found that the tuition was considerably higher in Oregon universities, but I didn't note as I looked at those that the fees did not stand out as being higher than universities, comparable universities in other places in the country. And I don't know whether you have information like that around. I don't know. This was just going online looking through the internet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, we do have detailed studies in comparison to our peer group. Yes. And I can tell you that our large institutions are lower than many of their peers. OIT, I believe, is one of the highest amongst his peers, and some of the smaller regional campuses are kind of mid-pack, but I can get you that data on Monday if you'd like.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, what I'll do is I will get the committee copies of the letter that I sent to the Chancellor and the university system about the resource fee issue, and I will also make a copy of the reply back. They had a date certain to reply back to me, which they did comply with that, and that will detail what they will be doing to discuss this issue further and report back to us, and that's part of the details to look at how other institutions across the country are using these fees. So I'll make sure we get copies of that for all of you.
Thank you, Senator Walker. So am I correct, Mr. Kent, the letter regarding the Institute for Natural Resources is pretty self-explanatory, or do you need to...
No, I believe it is.
Okay. All right, great. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Kent. I appreciate that, the getting back so quickly with that information and helping us.
Yeah. Oh, Senator Morse.
I've been waiting for the most important...
Oh, you have? All right, I don't want
to... Oh, which one?
Mr. Kent, please.
The reinvestment of the interest fund.
Oh, okay.
I apologize for being slow, but I need to understand whether the details, scenario 1, 2, 3, and 4, the investment options that you would consider, how do the yields per biennium, scenario 1 is essentially 0, mm-hmm. 2 is 10 million, 3 is 18 million, and 4 is 22 million. How does that relate to the present interest earnings that we have historically accrued to the general fund, and what would be the net gain if you were free to invest these funds in presumably scenario 4?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, these are all incremental over and above the $19 million that we estimate these funds generate today for the general fund. So these are all incremental earnings above that base. Okay, so when I said yesterday, I just want to clarify what I said to the committee yesterday about, I mentioned a number of $35 million. It's kind of in between the third and second scenario. Today, based on our monies being in the state treasurer's short-term investment fund, we make $19.1 million. If we moved it and split it half and half between the short-term fund and the intermediate fund, per these consultants' advice, we would make $29 million. If we did one-third in the short-term fund, one-third in the investment fund, and one-third in a multi-strategy bond fund, we'd earn $37 million. So the 35 I gave was kind of a ballpark number of the second and third. The fourth scenario would require constitutional changes. Noted here that that would be investments in equities, which is, as our understanding, is presently prohibited by the Oregon Constitution.
Senator Devlin,
if you went to the third scenario, which is the one that you said would be the most return without needing the constitutional amendment, did you have enough liquidity so that you could meet your cash flow requirements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that would put one-third, or it would stratify the cash, if you will, that bottom, that core cash, deep core cash, that doesn't get used often, would be invested in those bond funds. So, yes, we do believe we would have the liquidity to meet our current cash flow requirements, and we've offered to work with Treasury to make sure that it would work with them for the overall state cash flow needs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for prepping the morning.
Again, not to ask Mr. No, you're fine. I just want to highlight that this is an area that we need to be working more on. I think that to put this into some kind of an interim study group, this is screaming to me for a budget note, to put some kind of process in place to bring this into being. And the policy question between the distribution to the general fund or the distribution to the higher ed budget is one that needs to be had, but to leave this significant opportunity unrealized is
it is not good for the state of Oregon.
It's financially irresponsible.
Well, thank you, Representative. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I simply want to confirm a statement you made yesterday in regards to this potential change. You know that the State Treasurer's Office would continue to manage these funds, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's absolutely right.
Mr. Chair, and so given that, and excluding scenario four for the time being, the State Treasurer's Office has the option to explore scenarios one through three as it is, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, actually just a comment. So given that information, you know, even attaching a budget note is essentially just asking the State Treasurer to do his job.
Did you want?
Don't feel obligated.
That's fine. That's not a good investment. Is this a conceptual budget note that you think you want to put in there?
No.
I know. I'm just kidding. Senator Devlin.
Well, we're talking here outside a way to maybe look at this is that. Well, we don't really know what the other issues are that are out there in terms of why or why not would you not want to keep. Does the Treasurer have a reason that he wants to keep a certain portion of the funds in the short term beyond what the needs of the OUS system is? And no one here on this committee right now knows what those issues are. But the other issue, it looks like there would be an opportunity here if you could do this. Even from the standpoint, if we said to you, if this was possible with the State Treasury, and we would say the OUS system will receive everything beyond what the state would normally get into the general fund if it had been invested in the short-term funds. So you do this, everything that you get above that goes back to OUS. The base still stays in the general fund.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that was the agreement that we reached with the governor's office in submitting the budget.
Oh, okay.
There was an offset, if you will, for general fund equal to the 19.1.
Yeah. Right.
And so effectively it produces the same net result you're referring to.
Right.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Just a very quick comment. The area that Representative Morgan is raising is one of the areas that is regularly reviewed by the House Revenue Committee and by the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. Because, of course, those are areas that are within the overall cash management and finance issues, and also that related to our bond ratings for other debt. And the issues are complex. We have not gone into the detail that we probably have to in order to answer all those questions. This session, the committee in the House at least went into that kind of detail in 03, because of the serious cash flow problems the state was facing in response to the recession and the reduction in our income. We essentially cleaned out our savings accounts in all the different nooks and crannies, and the Treasurer needed guidance on how to manage the state's finances. I agree with Senator Morgan that a continuing review of this issue is needed. I don't know that it necessarily means that we need to wait on the issue that the department has raised. I the overall issue is more complex and larger, but I don't know that, but I think this fits within the policy that the state needs, and I think it would be useful for us to make that overall review. To do it this session it's probably too late.
Oh, I agree, but I think that I don't know what the structure of the committees is going to be in the interim. In the preliminary discussions that we had around the retiming of the session, it was keep the session structure of committees through the interim. So certainly there is an opportunity here to work on this from the perspective of potentially institutionalizing something in the spring session.
And I think this is a perfect segue, as we're talking about economic performance, to go into the performance measures for the system of higher education. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Kenton.
More paper.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
My staff was just quick on buying the hearing. So you'll have our letter from the committee as well as the university's response.
Okay, Mr. Bender.
Mr. Chair, members, in order to work through this performance measure review, I ask you to locate two documents which were distributed to me today and should be before you. One is a table labeled Table of Proposed Measures, and it's actually on the top. It says Oregon University System, November 13, 2006. There is a second item, which I admit is materials that were distributed yesterday, and I apologize for giving you second copies of things. I know you have enough paper already, but what I've done is put a couple of items together in one stapled package, so I think it would be helpful to have this in one package as you go through it. Finally, some of you, if I noticed that you didn't bring your, or you didn't have your presentation binder with you, I distributed a third table that the front page would say package number and title 112. If you do have your presentation binder, this material would be better found in that binder behind the performance measure tab, and we can locate that when we get there. But what I would recommend, Mr. Chair, in the time that we have remaining, is to simply briefly cover what the performance measures are and briefly discuss how the targets for these measures are projected to be impacted by the funding decisions that you are making. So this should give you a better idea of what the expected outcomes of some of these proposals in the budget are or might be if you choose to go ahead and fund them. So again, going back to the table here, the table of proposed measures, I think if you start flipping through, you can see, first of all, there are 29 different measures, and these relate to a number of things, and measures did go for review before the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. In the interim, there are a number of new measures that are being proposed here, and in the interest of time, I would just like to point to some of these measures to let you see the types of things that are being measured here. Page 4, you see performance measures 1 and 2. These performance measures relate to cost as a percent of income, cost of attending. These are measures of access. And the thing that I would ask you to note is that the projections or the targets remain constant at 29.6%. This reflects the increases in tuition rates in the governor's proposed budget of 3.4%, which was the projection at the time the budget was put together of the increase in median family income. So the target is to keep the total cost from increasing as a percent of median family income. Note that Measure 1 is a broad measure. It includes everything, tuition fees, room, board, other expenses, etc. The governor's budget and the co-chair's budget limit only the tuition rate increase to the rate of increase in median family income. So in order for this measure to be met, OUS would have to limit increases in the other fees that it charges generally to no more than a 3.4% increase as well. Other items to note are that if you look at number 3 on page 5, these are measures 3 and 4, both of these on page 5, are measures of
sort of the students that are coming into the system, a large proportion of the undergraduate students that come into the system enter either as freshmen or as community college transfers. Of course, that's not all of them. There are other students who transfer from other institutions that are not community colleges. But there have been attempts as both OUS and the community colleges have worked to make transfers between these institutions easier on students by reducing the necessary, by reducing unnecessary duplication of coursework when a student transfers from a community college to higher ed. Performance Measure 4 has been something that I know there's been significant interest in the legislature about helping to increase the number of community college students who transfer to the Oregon University system. And you can see there are actual data there, and the targets are actually, at least through 2007, are fairly robust to increase those numbers of transfers. Some other measures that I'd like to focus on, and I'm sorry, I really should tell you what this document is that you're looking at here. I sort of skipped over that. But this document is it reflects what Oregon University System submitted in their request to you for approval of performance measures and targets, and what with changes. I've made some changes to this. These are recommended changes, and the first of those show up on page 8 of this document. If you look at page 8, oops, I missed one. I think there was supposed to be a change on page on performance measure 8 as well. Let me just check that. But if you look at performance measure 9, persistence, this is a measure of the percent of full-time freshmen who return for the second year. And the system has been trying to increase this persistence rate and essentially reduce what is essentially a dropout rate at the post-secondary level. The targets that they have proposed initially were for 82% in the 2008 persistence and 82.5% in 2009. If I may, I would like to explain why we're recommending that these targets be changed, and that is because these new targets assume that you do approve the packages in the co-chair's budget. If you do not approve those, we would not recommend these changes. But I just wanted to show some of the impacts of what the co-chair's budget would have on persistence rates, or at least how the system would target what its persistence rates would become. As you can see, this particular measure is not highly affected by the additional investments that are in the co-chair's budget above the essential budget level. The numbers, fluctuations are small compared to some fluctuations that you would see typically just from year to year. But the reason or the rationale for this, and this is where I would ask you to look at your performance measure binder, or if you do not have that, I did provide a separate handout here, 112, and I've got a few copies of this as well if people want those who have their performance measure binders with them. But if you go behind the performance measure tab, the last item behind that tab is a report on how to develop peer groups. The item that precedes that is the item that I'm referring to here. And if you look, this is an item that's dated April 9th and has 31 pages. If you go to page 3, you will see that this is a form that reflects the impact on performance measures of approval of Package 112. Package 112 is $8 million in supplemental funding to for faculty salaries. It's called the Faculty Salary Catch-Up Package. It's estimated that if that package is approved, higher ed will be able to increase, on average, faculty salaries by approximately 1% more each year than they would be able to approve without the package. The question is, if they do that, will there be any, what are the measurable performance outcomes that the system is indicating they expect to achieve? On page 3, you can see that they're expecting this particular package to have impacts on 2 of the 29 key performance measures that we're going through. The first of those is number 9, where they're projecting that if this is approved, the persistence rate in 2008 would not be 82%, but would be 0.25% above that. So that's why on the document that I have here, I'm recommending that you change the target to 82.25 if you go ahead and do indeed approve package 112, which is now funded in the co-chair's budget. Also, I increased it by 0.15% the 2009 target. So that's the basic methodology that will be here as we go through this. Since you are looking at page 3 here in the binder, you may just want to look at some of these other, if we could just work through some of these things here. You can see if you go to page 5, student faculty ratio improvement, that would be funding of about $6.9 million, slightly less than $6.9 million. Question is, will all that impact have on the student faculty ratio? Higher Ed is reporting that that would reduce the student-faculty ratio from 25.3, which is where it would be projected to be, down to 25. How would that compare with the most recent data that we have information for? The most recent data that we have information for shows the student-faculty ratio of 25 students per faculty member, 25.7 on average. So this would allow an additional reduction. You will note that although higher ed has had to face funding reductions from the state, in part of this period that you see here, they have been able to reduce the student-faculty ratio from a high of 27.9 in 2003 down to 25.7. So they have been showing improvement in this at the levels of funding that the state has provided recently. The next item, if you go forward on enrollment growth, one of the measures that of access that Oregon University System tracks is the Oregon freshman participation rate in OUS institutions. And this is simply a ratio of the number of high school graduates in Oregon to the number of those of incoming Oregon freshmen, resident freshman students, the next fall. And as you can see, currently, approximately 21% in 2005 of Oregon high school graduates went to be or enrolled in an OUS school the next year. And that number has fluctuated. It's down from 24.1%. I would like to indicate that or state that a change from 24.1% to 21.1% or to 20.9%, although it may not seem, maybe it does seem like a lot to you, but if it doesn't seem like a lot to you, it actually has a very large impact and is into the number of Oregon freshmen that are coming in. If you look at the numbers as opposed to the ratio, a rather small adjustment in this ratio is a pretty major change. What you can see here is that the institution is expecting that without the enrollment growth package funding, that the participation rate would basically, or they would target the participation rate to be at the levels it was in 2005. That's to say, we would hope to hold a rate of 21.1% of high school graduates going to an OUS institution the following year. With the additional funding, they would recommend increasing those targets by about 0.5% the first year and about a full percentage point the second year. Again, if you want to see what a full percentage point is, you know, the 1.04, you can see that, again, there are fluctuations from year to year that occur that are much larger than that in terms of percentage magnitude, but this is the impact they would project.
Mr. Chairman.
Sam Morse.
Thank you. Probably the real number is not... maybe absolutely relative number, it's the benchmark number, how Oregon compares to other states. Particularly, if you correlate it to the disinvestment numbers, where we rank number 50, we're leading the nation in disinvestment, how is that translated into percentage of students that we're actually capturing in our system versus that are either not going or we're going elsewhere?
Yes, that's a very interesting measure. I've not seen interstate comparisons. I don't know if the system already has looked at that to any extent. This would vary greatly, I believe, from state to state. Some different states have very different sizes of their public education four-year sector.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another, I appreciate that would be a useful measure to have. I think another useful measure would be a criterion-based measure based on where we'd like to end up. I know in the, I believe in this committee, and I know in the Workforce Committee, the statements were made over and over again that eventually we need to have 40% of our population, workforce population, educated at the university level. And of course they don't all have to go to OUS colleges to do that, but the goal, long-term goals at least, ought to be related to that objective, if that is in fact the right objective. Obviously we're taking into account that we get people with bachelor's degrees from other places as well.
Thank you, Representative. Some of the other outcomes projected of the enrollment growth funding are in number 18 and 19. Although you see no target impacts noted in the tables there, it is in longer range effects. The system does believe that it will be able to award an additional 150 to 200 bachelor's degrees annually beginning in 2011. With this additional funding, assuming it's maintained through that period of time. And in number 19, which is the advanced degrees, master's, doctoral, and professional, that number would increase by an additional 135 to 140 degrees per year. So these are some expectations of what the system believes it can attain with the additional funding in the enrollment growth package, which, as a reminder, if you have the forms, the letters that we were looking at yesterday or previously, the amount of funding in that particular package is, that's the package that is $14.6 million in general fund, and that, again, is funded in the co-chair's budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. I think number 19 is not a meaningful measure unless it's disaggregated. The cost and the need for different levels of master's, doctoral, and professional degrees are very widely. We might not be terribly concerned, and I'll risk my wife's wrath here, we may not be enormously concerned about making sure we have more PhDs in Old English, but we may be very concerned about having more master's level engineers.
Thank you, Representative. If I may skip ahead, well, it's probably, I don't know if there's another time to go further into that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Steve. And so, colleagues, we obviously we don't meet tomorrow. Senator Devlin or the chair.
chair will, well, Senator Devlin will probably contact members of the Senate, and I will contact those of you on our side, and to discuss, and then we'll come back on Monday for a work session on Bill 5515. So with that, I'm going to close the work session, and we're adjourned.